Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is a personal friend of mine, whom I have known for about a year now. This young man is relatively new to Chicago. He is an actor, singer, composer, whose Broadway musical credits include playing Marios in a national production of Les Miserables in New Zealand. He makes his dramatic stage debut in Chicago playing Alan Strang in a spellbinding production of Equus, now playing at Actors Workshop in Chicago. Welcome, Peter Oilo.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Let me start by saying that your performance as Alan in Equus was a true tour de force. You were astounding. I knew you'd be good, but indeed you were electrifying. You know, it is so nice to see people I know do so well. Since I've been doing these interviews over the last few years, I've shared fine moments with many terrific actors here in Chicago, and I'm elated to have you among them. Congratulations. The reviews that you and the show are getting have been amazingly positive.
Well, thank you. That's very flattering because Chicago is filled with some tremendously talented people, and I'm, you know, looking forward to hopefully getting in the game.
Well, that's a nice way to start. I know your background is quite varied, but to make your debut playing one of the toughest roles in theater has got to be amazing.
Oh, it's just been a tremendous experience all around.
Well, tell us now, how did you get cast as Alan?
I'd been going to quite a few shows, and I'd come across the director Joe Stead. I'd met him at a few different shows, and we talked about theater and things, and he was talking to me one time about his passion for this play Equus, and I'd read it before, you know, several years ago, but I'd never seen a performance of it or anything, and he invited me to audition for it as he sort of put the project together.
Well, that's great. That's quite flattering. Did you realize how tough a role it was when he decided to cast you as Alan?
Well, you know, it's challenging on a lot of different levels, you know, because it's a character that's very much rooted in the emotional aspects of being a human, and so it's not so much about, you know, it's the structure of learning the lines and things like that. It's more about, you know, just trying to be truly honest about, you know, the emotional aspects of the character.
Okay, for those who have not gotten up to Bryn Mawr Avenue to see the show, and folks, this is a must-see show. Tell us what Equus is about.
What Equus is about? Equus is about this young man named Alan Strang, and he's been admitted to this hospital to go through a process with a psychiatrist named Martin Dysart, and he's been he has blinded these horses with a metal spike, a hoof pick, and
so he committed a crime against the horses in a fit of rage, kind of thing.
Yeah, a very violent, terrible crime. And you know, people's first reactions are to say, "Well, send this person away forever, and they're no longer should be part of society." And it's a little more complicated than that. So he's trying to uncover, you know, what's at the root of what would cause such a young person.
So it's kind of a psychological mystery. Are they trying to figure out why he did what he did?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, and it's such a terrific piece of writing.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible on so many levels. It's beautifully written, and the characters are very, you care about all the characters actually in the show.
So without giving away certain things, so now this psychiatrist is trying to find out why he did treat him.
Right.
Is there anything special about Alan, or is he just another patient? It's obviously a tough case, because why would a kid do that, particularly when he was working at a stable, right? And he loved the horses.
Right. He's totally enamored of the horses, and he sees them as this god figure, and they take on this incredible role in his life, and so that adds some more complexities to why he might have done it, So it's a relationship, the relationship between Dysart and Alan, and how they actually help each other. But then the question in Dysart's mind is, well, this character is so passionate, and I feel I'm envious of his passion, but by me treating him in the quote-unquote clinical sense, am I actually going to be taking that away?
What particular challenges does the role possess for you?
Well, the character is not written in the sense that it gives you a lot of leading emotions. So it's about uncovering the honesty of the character and allowing yourself to be completely vulnerable within the character, because you know he won't accept any less, really.
Well, I've seen several productions of this, and I've seen several very strong Allens, but one of the traps that they get in, and these you were meticulously avoided, one is playing him just as this Looney Tunes, where the early scenes when he's not speaking, he just looks like a demented, crazy kid. You didn't do that, although that element was there. The other one was to play him as this passionate kid that for no reason just goes into a rage. You didn't do that. What I thought you did that really made it work was you blended the two, and you slowly built, and you the more the play went on, the more we realized the depth of his passion, and you became scarier and scarier.
Well, I think he wants a way to share this with someone else. I mean, he's never had an opportunity to share his deep inner person with other people, and his way of expressing has been through with the horses, because they accept him.
The mother was a fanatic, religious fanatic, right? That kind of shoved religion down his throat.
His father was very overbearing and told him the things that don't work about, you know, being a young person, things that you don't do and the things that you shouldn't do, and these things are bad and these things are good, and kind of creating a very, you know, black and white sort of scenario. And Allen has so much more color to his life, because, you know, he's tied up in his fantasies and his passions and his dreams and
so he confuses. He sort of sees the horses as a god figure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he confuses the horses, the sexuality, the religion. It's all kind of screwed up. Which he wouldn't be the only adolescent, but obviously because his passion is so deep, that it just manifests itself emotionally quite strong.
Right, and then his relationship with Dysart
tell us about that. How you established a chemistry with Brian Perry, who plays Dysart, you were strong, and he was equally as strong on the other end.
He's a terrific actor and a terrific person. He's such a smart actor, and he's really very conscious about the choices that he makes, and he thinks about the text, and he's really respectful of the text, and he's respectful of the context of how things are put together, and he's very respectful of the other actors. So it was really great working with him, and it was really great working with all these people, because at some point I had to go into some very vulnerable places myself, and I've always felt very supported by the cast, and I felt very respected.
And it comes through in the show, and I agree with you. Brian Perry is the best Dysart, and Josted's decision to do it without the British accents helped a lot, because not that you guys can't do it. I've heard Dysart do it, and I've heard you do it. I know you can both do them, but what happened is that his articulation of the opening narratives and some of the key speeches he has to give that really brings home the meanings were very strong.
Well, I think this is one of the contemporary classic plays, because I think we're trying to illustrate how universal this theme can be, and you know it doesn't necessarily need to be tied into place. Though you know Peter Schaeffer is. You know, he's an Englishman, so he wrote, you know, you write what you know. And, you know, we didn't want to disrespect that aspect of it, but we're just trying to say, well, you know, it's a play about being a human being.
Tell us how you reached the passion in that Act One ending scene where you're writing Nugget. It kind of explain that scene, because to me it's the key to the whole play. Because if we don't buy your passion for the horses and this sort of love affair and this deep emotional connection, then Act Two doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, that's kind of one of the last places that I visited within the play And if you read it just as the text, you know, you kind of say, well, how do you intellectualize this? And you can't, basically. So what I did, what I tried to do anyway, was once all the mechanisms were in place and I knew where I was going to be on stage, and I knew, you know, how my interaction with Daniel, who plays Nugget, was going to be, then I was able to just try to give myself to that scene and say, well, you know, now I can lose myself into the ecstasy of this. And I see so much ecstasy in this play. And
you were there. You were there. It was astounding. All right, now tell us, what is your process toward building the emotional strength or vulnerability necessary to do these that wrenching scene and the scene we'll talk about coming up, the ending scene, because this is a build up. Mm-hmm. You're building up slowly, and we can see it and we can feel it. I could feel it all through the we could feel the tension building.
Well, you know, at the beginning, Alan is—he's very defensive, and
he's hostile. Yeah,
yeah, and I've tried to not let that, you know, take over the scenes. So it's kind of a buildup. Like he's not giving too much away because he doesn't have trust. He doesn't know how to trust these people necessarily. So, you know, as he feels like, especially with, you know, his relationship with Dysart, as he feels more and more. He has more and more trust for him, and he wants to communicate these things, and so as that is uncovered, he becomes more and more vulnerable, and therefore I've tried to, you know, have him become more and more what's the word, you know, he lets out more of his inner turmoil.
Whereas yeah, before, I can see it. Every once in a while, it explodes a little bit, and then you pull it back a little bit, as a defensive person would. But in between, since you're on stage virtually the entire show, in all the other scenes, you're usually staring, and that's a big part of the show. Where did you come up with that stare? I mean, it looked like you were looking right through us at the audience.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I've always enjoyed looking people in the eye, and eyes are. You know, as is a motif of this play, they're very powerful windows into a persona, and I don't know. I've just tried to. I don't even know how to answer that question, I suppose.
Well, however you got there, it was very effective. You know, but now let's go into you're reaching the pain and you're doing all this build up, and then you have this climactic naked nude scene with Maura Kidwell. That was done so tastefully and telling, and it wasn't exploitative, and it was just so much a part of the character. How do you approach doing a nude scene, especially with a beautiful woman?
Well, this is funny because, you know, when people talk about this play, this is the first thing they talk about is the nude scene. You know,
that's because of Daniel Radcliffe. You know,
well, even before that, everyone knows it as the nude play, and you know, this is supposed to testament to our culture in a way, but you know, I wasn't necessarily. I wasn't necessarily afraid of that scene because I really respect the play and I really respect how it's used within the play. So it's not gratuitous and it's not exploitive. And my relationship that I've built up with Maura as an actress, you know, I can't think of anyone else that I.
Yeah, it comes off real true.
We just have such a respect and trust with each other, and that was so important. And
because she's tell us what she's trying to do. She's trying to, well, seduce you, but she's also trying to, you know, give you an experience.
Right.
You're this shy kid that's all wound up.
And Alan wants to have that experience.
Yeah, and she wants like this good-looking guy who she knows there's a connection there.
Right. So it was about respect, and to me that's so important. And I always wanted Maura to know that she had that she could trust me, and that I could trust her, and that there was respect. So we could have just jumped right into it and said, well, let's just do it because that's what we're supposed to do. But that's not the process that we wanted to take. So
no, it was very natural.
It was about asking permission. It was saying, okay, is this okay? Can we add this element? And we spent a lot of time, you know, talking through it and asking permission and just really caring about each other.
In your preparation before a show, do you become Alan?
I take some moments of reflection, and I sort of relax within myself, and I try to, you know, we all have those things, especially living in the city, I come from a very quiet part of the world originally, but try to, you know, cleanse out some of those external distractions.
One of the other elements that I liked in the show, one of them was the decision that was made when they do this climactic scene, was to have Dysart in the back of the stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly Brian Perry has a strong enough voice. I mean, he could have been down the block. We'd have heard.
Right,
he's got
right.
a good set of pipes.
He does.
But when you do that, what it does, it turned and made the entire focus of the audience being on you telling your story, you reliving this dream,
mm-hmm.
both the good parts and, of course, the horrible parts. And it just changed the focus of it. And I thought that was extremely effective.
Great. And, yeah, we've been getting some great feedback on that. And it's really exciting to hear people who have seen the play before and really love the play. I mean, and saying, well, we actually saw some new things this time, and you know, we've tried to make it our own in our way. And I'm just really proud and excited.
Yeah, that's you should be proud. I mean, it's these are the kind of experiences years from now when you're this big name, you know, star somewhere, which probably will be. You'll look back to these moments and say these are the things that helped shape your career. So congratulations on that. Now let's have a little commercial. It's the Actors Workshop. Do you know the address, or do you want me to give that?
It's 1044 West Bryn Mawr Avenue.
Okay.
So that's right off the Bryn Mawr Red Line stop.
Yeah, right off the Red Line. And you do Fridays, Saturdays at 8 o'clock?
Yes.
Sundays at 3?
That's correct.
Okay. And they can go to theactorsworkshop.org. And get tickets, right?
Right, right.
And I heard they're a hot commodity, that you better order them ahead of time, because it only seats, what, like 35 or
and
so.
And we're also doing something really special for industry people, where every night other than closing weekend, we're offering reduced industry tickets. And those, if they're booked in advance, then they'll honor those.
So how much are?
They're $10.
Wow, with a resume and a photo?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, but, you know, folks, Peter Oilo is much more than a terrific dramatic actor. He is a recorded folk singer with a CD. He's a songwriter. He's a musical theater artist. He's a dancer, voiceover talent, playwright, print model, and aspiring actor.
Wow, and I'm still broke.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't mean you don't have a body of work. So tell us about your background and you know, where you came from and so forth, because you're new in town. People are getting to know you.
Well, you know, I was born in Northeast Iowa. And my on a dairy goat farm, and that was significant in the fact that, you know, it made my life very family centered, but all my family very strong individuals, and you know, I have three siblings, and you know, I learned a work ethic. You know, I spent time on the farm. I didn't always like doing that stuff necessarily, but I wouldn't have changed.
So you are the rare breed of artists that's not afraid to get his hands dirty and do hard work.
No, I like it. I actually enjoy it. I love working hard and working on projects. And, you know, I'm really thankful for my parents that, you know, sort of the last of your do-it-yourself generation. They taught me how to do things and be very self-sufficient. So I feel very comfortable in a lot of different environments.
I remember you telling me one time that unless you can cook, in order to eat, you should be able to cook.
Yeah,
that's testimony to me with microwaving or restaurants, right?
Well, I mean, we all need to eat, and we all like to eat, and I would just like to think that, you know, we should learn to feed ourselves, maybe. But
so tell us now. I mean, how you started out as a folk singer or as an actor or what? I mean, you're.
Well, I don't. I've always sung. You know, my father is secretly a beautiful singer. I haven't heard him sing real recently, but he always introduced me to all his old records, you know. And in kindergarten, when I was 5 years old or whatever, I had a music teacher that really encouraged me to sing, and I always loved singing. And then when I was 10 years old, I started out doing acting stuff and music, and I was in the Carmen Children's Choir for the opera Carmen, and ever since then I've just really just loved performing. And but not for the reasons that I feel when I'm performing that I'm optimizing all of my energies. If that makes any sense, I
yes,
feel
it
like
does.
I feel like I'm totally alive and totally engaged, and I'm loving fully, and I'm being emotional, and I'm using my intellectual mind, and I'm being spiritual. I just feel like a whole person when I'm doing it. So,
and you love the write too. You like composing music.
Oh yeah, I do.
And your CD is terrific.
Well, thank you.
Which, by the way, if you come to the show, I even come up with the idea of the capitalist I am, they have them in the lobby, and some people are buying them, right?
Yeah.
Great, good. I mean, they're terrific, and it's good to get the word around. Have you got any feedback from people who have listened to them?
Yeah, people, you know, it's a CD that was written, you know, over some time, but it's a very personal CD in a lot of ways, and people have said that it's sort of melancholic, which is
folksy kind of way. The lyrics are terrific,
yeah.
And the orchestrations are very good too.
But it's a contemplative CD, I guess, and people have really enjoyed listening to it in the dark, and it makes people have told me that it affects them, and that's all that I really want.
That's a nice feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, now give us some of the roles that you have played in musicals, both dramatic and in musical, you know,
okay.
In theater.
Well, I've played Macheath in Threepenny Opera, and I've been, you know, ensemble in a lot of different shows. Like, I've been in Carousel, I've been in West Side Story, I've been in Little Mary Sunshine, which they haven't produced that here, have they?
No, we might put that on our list.
No, I've played Lancelot and Camelot, and
tell us how you got Marius in the national production of Les Miserables in New Zealand.
That's a story that I like, actually, because I'd gone to New Zealand originally for 6 months.
Yeah, what got a farm boy from Iowa all the way down to New Zealand?
I fell in love with it. I've always loved the natural environment, and I've loved plants and animals. And ever since I was 14, there were two things that I remember being 14 and saying, well, I saw this book on New Zealand and fell in love with it, and I knew I wanted to go there. And then my mom had gotten me the Broadway CD of Les Mis, and I knew I really wanted to play Marius in Les Mis. And I ended up going to New Zealand, and I was over at a friend's house, and she said that she was going to some audition. And just out of curiosity, I said, well, what audition are you going to? And she said, well, they're auditioning Les Mis downtown. I said, really? Can I go? And she said, yeah, I don't see why not. So I called them up right away, and I actually got the last audition spot on the last day. And it went really well. And such a tremendous experience because I became really good friends with a lot of people in the cast, and actually became really good friends with the musical director of the show, and we became, you know, pretty much best friends, and he was very supportive of everything, and it's just incredible to be part of such a show and such a cast, and, you know, so out of, you know, 500 people that auditioned or whatever, I got to be in it.
How do you deal with the rejection of auditioning? I know it's been tough getting roles here in Chicago only because people don't know you. That's why this playing Alan is such a breakthrough for you. How do you deal with that?
Well, it gets easier all the time, I suppose. Kind of leaving your pride at the door. And I understand, you know, as I've coded, there's a lot of talented people in this town. This is a big town, and you know, and it's not that I'm not new to this field of work. I'm new to this pool of players. So, you know, I've had a lot of, I would say I'm not, my audition skill is not my greatest skill. It's something that
you're not alone on that.
That I want to get better at. But, you know, I've gone and I've had some really good auditions, and, you know, I get a lot of callbacks, and that feels really good. You know, just a little bit of, you know, assurance that, hey, you're doing all right. You know, maybe you're not particular right for this role, but you know, we appreciate what you're doing, and that feels good. I mean, that's all.
Yeah, it's so arbitrary, and sometimes it's you're too tall or you're too short or who you're playing with.
Yeah,
you know, there's so many of those arbitrary decisions, but the fact that you're getting the positive feedback, because the rejection has got to be. I remember Iris Lieberman in one of these interviews, old-time equity actor, you know Iris, and she said at any given time, 98% of the equity actors in America are out of work.
Yeah.
And less than 1% ever get a long tour. So she says you just mentally have to deal with that.
Right. Well, I just, you know, I just want to, like I said before, I just want to be in the game. So, you know, it's not about, you know, it's not about me necessarily. It's just, I want to participate, you know.
All right. Now let me put you on the spot. Okay. You're this accomplished folk singer. You wrote original things. I've heard you doing some of the classic folk tunes. And so you're this folk singer who does concerts, and you're this musical comedy guy, and you're the serious dramatic actor. How do you balance? Do you think you can balance all three?
I get asked that question a lot, and people always want me to pick and choose.
Well, I didn't ask you that. I may, too, but I'm asking you, how do you balance all three?
Well, they're all brewing inside me at any one time, but, you know, part of it has to do with what projects present themselves. And the thing about my folk music, though I want to share it with other people, and I do, it's a very personal thing to me. So just having my guitar around it, I'm always playing it. I'm always touching it and participating with it here at home and writing songs. And, you know, I've got, you know, I've one CD that's actually come out. I'm working on a new one now, but, you know, I have hundreds of songs that aren't finished, and, you know, as I get some money together, I'll hopefully be recording more. But
so that's something that'll be an ongoing, because that's just an extension of who you are.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of the questions that I try and ask everybody when I do these profiles.
Okay.
Where does Peter Oilo want to be in 5 years?
What
are your dreams? What are you going to be in 5 years?
Okay, that's a good question. There's a couple goals that I've always had for myself. I've always had this idea that I want to play on Austin City Limits. I think that's just tremendous pinnacle of musical, not necessarily success, but it's a very beautiful setting to me. But in 5 years, I want to be making my living just doing meaningful projects that move me and make me feel.
So you don't want a day job. You don't want to work to work. You want to create art.
That's right. I work to work. That's a funny question. That's a funny way to put it. You know, what is a day job? I don't know. And how we can ever sort of, this whole idea that we settle, practical, these type of words, I just can't relate to them at all. And so I struggle along, but I'm not afraid of struggling along. And I make very little money right now, but I live very well. And my life is filled with people that I care about and love genuinely, and people that care about and love me genuinely. So I feel really, just really honored.
Life is good.
It is. It's really good. And, you know, growing up, I had a penchant for darkness, you know, and I can be a brooding person. My mom will be the first to tell people about that. But, you know, more and more, I'm choosing joy, and I'm seeing the joy in the world. And there are a lot of things that really frustrate me. And there's a lot of things I could talk about in my relationship to the socially constructed world, I always call it. But it's my life. To me, the most important thing in my life is my relationships with other people. And part of this performing comes in is relationships with other people, because every time that I get on stage, whether it's in Equus or whether I'm playing some folk songs, I'm really sharing my love with those people. And maybe that sounds funny to some people, but
no, it doesn't.
But I really believe that. And I'm being vulnerable with those people, and that's part of love.
Coming up, if you could wave a magic wand, tell us a couple of roles that you'd like to play.
Well, I've always wanted to play, you know, as a young man, Biff in Death of a Salesman, because that's another play that I just think is monumental.
Good role, yes.
I've always wanted to take it. I haven't done a lot of Shakespeare. I mean, I've done a lot of scene work on Shakespeare, and done a lot of, I've seen most Shakespeare plays, and I've certainly read them all. But I'd really love to just try the challenge of Hamlet. And I have some my own theories and ideas about how I might play it. But That's a character I would love to try.
How about musical roles?
Well, I'd like to play the role of Skye Masterson in Guys and Dolls. I think that's a really fun, interesting musical. And some of these more contemporary musicals, I love Stephen Sondheim music. So pretty much doing any of his shows.
As Bobby and Company. You'd be a slam dunk for that. Let's hope somebody does it. And you know, next year Marriott is going to do Les Mis. Would you love to have them cast you as Marius?
Yeah, well, we'll wave a little magic wand.
We got a year. People are now knowing who you are. You know, you'll have landed a musical by then.
And
hint, hint to the Marriott people. They got to come see you in Equus, because if they'll hear you singing, and you know, if they buy the CD or come to some of the other things. But you know, if I'm casting somebody who I know is a singer and I see him do a dramatic role as strong as Alan, I say, man, if that guy can do that, if he can sing at all, I'm going to put him in my musical.
Well, I mean, the thing is that I use my voice in different ways. My folk music is one type of voice that I use, and I've started to write some more bluesy kind of songs and use my voice a little bit differently there, but then I also use my legitimate voice for...
Well, Peter, we have to end this interview. This has been great. I really appreciate you sharing, you know, your thoughts in a deep manner, as you always do. And keep up the terrific work.
Oh, well, thank you.
And folks, thank you for listening to this interview. This is Tom Williams reminding you, go see a play this week. Thank you.